Hello to all you boys next door, mums and dads, new weds and nearly deads, and welcome to Dangerous Amusements, a podcast where we talk about the music of Elvis Costello. I'm Stu Arrowsmith, and in each episode I'll be joined by a special guest to chat all things Elvis, and I'll be asking them to help me compile the ultimate Elvis Costello playlist. Now remember, don't make any sudden movements, because these are Dangerous Amusements. I'm delighted to welcome to Dangerous Amusements comedian, writer, TV presenter, radio host, Mark Lamar.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you very much for having me on. It hasn't been quite a lifelong obsession, but the majority, I would guess.
Oh, thank you for coming on. I know you don't do a lot of interviews, so I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know a lot of people listening here will be followers of yours on Twitter, where you curate and recommend music from your collection, and you've said that's where you broadcast now.
Yeah, sort of. I'm not sure how long I'll be doing that. I love sharing music with people. I'm not sure Twitter's the best place to do it, and I might have to not do it. But I've been collecting records since I was about 10-ish, I suppose. And I've got an extraordinary amount and some extraordinary music that most people don't get to hear. So it's just that's a little itch I like to scratch every now and again of like, hey, listen to this. Everyone else, I suppose, really.
I read somewhere else you saying that your collection is comfortably into the tens of thousands by now. Is that right?
Oh, no. I would say probably near 100,000.
Right.
I'm not sure. I did stop counting at about 1979 or something. But, but yeah, a stupid amount, more than anyone should ever have.
Yeah, and I'm intrigued by what your music setup is like. I'm picturing a dedicated room, maybe a drinks cabinet, a Chesterfield, maybe.
No, if only it's a dedicated floor. I have nowhere to sit because there's just piles and miles of records. And just, I often buy the thousand. And so there's always just crates to go through and clean and file and all of that. Obsessive collector OCD stuff that's not always about the music and is often about the artifact, which I've realized I love the artifact as much as the music. I have all that stuff on MP3 as well, but it doesn't bring me the same satisfaction of getting a record out of a sleeve and all of that old man fogey stuff that I still enjoy.
Yeah. You were telling me that Elvis Costello is well represented in that collection. Can you recall how you came to hear his music for the first time?
I remember vividly seeing, do you remember that period when he used to walk on the sides of his shoes?
Yeah.
Which just seemed the most punk thing in the world to me. Everything at the time in sort of 77, 78 seemed the most punk thing in the world. And you're a little younger than me. The way that history's written about punk is that it kind of enveloped everything and took over everything. And it's just not the case. You saw and heard very little punk or new wave or any of that on mainstream media at the time. You'd read about it. It was literally on the front page of The Sun, which we got in my house every day of the week. But it was like this mythical phoenix thing that happened somewhere else. And so you didn't hear much or see much. So anything, if you saw someone, Ian Dury, with a safety pin through his ear or whatever, it was the most exciting thing in the world. It was kind of this representation of this stuff that you'd heard about happening elsewhere. And seeing Elvis was one of those things. He was very certainly at the time of Pump It Up, he was obsessed with the Clash and that energy. And so, yeah, that's the first image I remember. And it seems odd that I wouldn't have heard of I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea. And maybe I did. But that to me was what was like, wow, look at this guy. And also, it just being called Elvis was absolutely, it doesn't seem silly now, but it was so shocking. And the fact that he was plainly geeky, which you don't think of Elvis as geeky now. He's kind of a venerated old man of rock sort of thing. And an intellectual, and he's sown so many seeds and worked with so many different people. But at the time, it was like very thrilling. Skinny little bloke with National Health glasses, screaming about something on Top of the Pops was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe you had a great passion for poetry back then and perhaps still do now. Does that love of language influence the kind of songwriters that you go for?
No, I don't think it does. I think, you know what, Wilco Johnson, who passed, I mean, literally an hour or so before we started recording this, said a great thing in an interview recently, and it's become a real obsession of mine, that he said songwriting isn't poetry, it's a series of slogans. And it's sort of changed the way I look at music now, because I used to sometimes think, oh yeah, that's a deep thought, but it's not, it's a couplet. It's a little moment caught in time, a little pithy thought. And so I don't really think of, I don't like music particularly because of that. I like instrumentals a lot. I like music that makes no sense. I like all sorts of things. But Elvis was so brilliant at that sloganeering. And I think Pump It Up, that little period, you know, that Radio, which we're going to come to in a minute, and I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea, they're just loads and loads of pithy little slogans. They're not really stories. Watching the Detective is much more of a story, but it's still just packed with pithy slogans. And I don't, yeah, I don't see music as sort of faux poetry anymore since, and maybe I will in a few years, but at the moment, I'm this Wilco Johnson quote about, no, it's just slogans.
Yeah.
And I don't think that demeans it at all. I think that's really hard to whittle down an enormous thought process to a rhyming couplet is pretty great. And lots of comics, or certainly of my generation, were really into Elvis. I mean, amount of times I've been to gigs and bumped into someone like a Mark Billigan or someone who, you know, I did the comedy circuit with. Because I think just because that precision of words is very important sometimes to a joke. Not always, but sometimes it is, that economy of words. And Elvis is very good at that. Well, at his best, he's very good at that. At his worst, he's very poor at that. as is everyone, I suppose, you know, at their worst.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let's start working our way through some of the songs that you've picked out for us. You've already touched on the first one that we're going to talk about, but as with everyone who comes on the show, I've asked you to pick out some of your favourite Costello songs. In each season, we build a playlist with each guest choosing one song from each decade of Elvis's career, from the 1970s to the 2020s. The new playlist is called Bedroom Alibis and will be up on my website, dangerousamusements.co.uk, at the end of the series. So let's begin in the 1970s. So there we go. First choice, Radio.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd pick this apart from any other reason than nostalgia, really, because I don't think it does fit in the great canon of his greatest work. But as an 11-year-old, hearing it just seemed like the most rebellious thing in the world. Someone singing about how bad radio was and then expecting it to be played on radio, which it was a little bit. You know, it followed up Pump It Up, which was, I remember, as his big breakthrough. And radio was on the radio quite a lot, actually, but wasn't a massive hit. But it just felt, just, I mean, that whole spirit of punk, which I'm sometimes a bit down on these days, because I think the music of it was overrated. But there was a crackle in the air for a year or two. And my whole thing about punk is that it gave us new wave, which I much prefer. I much prefer the crafted songs of a Squeeze or a Blondie or Ian Dury than I do to the early Clash or Pistols. You know, much as I like those, I think the great thing that it gave us was a feeding frenzy amongst major labels to find young skinny men who could sing quickly. And some of those ended up as, you know, talents that sort of informed our lives.
Mm. The song was originally titled Radio Soul, and Costello performed it with Flip City, and he revived that version of the song for his solo tours in the 2010s. Radio Radio as We Know It, recorded with The Attractions and produced by Nick Lowe at Eden Studios, released, as you say, as a single in the UK in October 78, where it reached number 29 in the charts. It was named Single of the Week in Sounds, where Tony Mitchell praised its purposeful, gritty organ work and Costello's lyrics, concluding, "Got to be big." And of course, everyone will always point to the line, "The radio's in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anaesthetise the way that you feel." That brings to mind one or two programme controllers that I've worked for, and I wouldn't want to put words in your mouth, Mark, but I don't know if you've encountered that in your broadcasting career as well.
I mean, it's almost all. I mean, it's a big business. I don't particularly bemoan that. It's a big business and it has to do what it has to do. But yeah, that's exactly what most controllers do. And anyone in TV or radio or any kind of broadcast media who's lucky enough to hit at a time when the person in control, and usually only very briefly, isn't like that, is absolutely blessed. You know, and I've had a couple of those situations in my life, and I've mostly had situations where it is such a lot of fools trying to anaesthetize the way that you feel, unfortunately. Can I ask you, as someone who wasn't listening to the radio in 1978, how you think about Radio Radio? Because I know I don't think it's his greatest record of the 70s, but it's one that brings back a lot of exciting memories for me.
Yeah, I like it because to me it's in that early Attraction sound with the organ, the driving rhythm of it, and Elvis's really aggressive vocal. Nobody else uses the word anaesthetize in a pop song lyric, which I really like as well. But as you say, I think it's bigger than the song, isn't it? Because it came to symbolise something, and it was him marking out his territory. You know, when your friend Joe Brand was on, we talked about him, you know, doing it on Saturday Night Live, which has become such an iconic moment, which helped to shape his reputation in people's eyes. And yeah, I think it's greater than its musical merit, if you like. And that's not to say it's not a great song, but what it represents has become much bigger, I think.
Yeah, and again, and I won't talk about it again, but that whole spirit of punk thing, making a record like it's the last time you'll ever be heard. Mm. Do you know what I mean? That record, if he just made that one record, people would be going, wow, what a talent we missed with this guy who was so frenzied and couldn't wait to express his passion and confusion. You know, it's almost what a 17-year-old boy should have written.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is one of those things of that period when he was so obsessed with that first Clash album, and it brought that manic energy that, from what I've heard of Flip City, he certainly didn't have then. And from what I've heard of much of his later, more mid-paced work, isn't necessarily a natural thing to him, you know. Mm. I don't know.
Mm. Just to go back to your sort of radio career, I think obviously one of the things that marked it out was that you were always someone who would champion music that you loved, and it wasn't necessarily going off what the station playlist was at the time. That was obviously really important to you.
Well, it wasn't. It's not even that it was important. It was just I couldn't do without it. You know, whatever show I did, that was the guiding line was I would always say I'm not going to play anything off the playlist, and if you want me to, then I'm just not going to work here. So it wasn't like a sort of big statement. It was just like, but that's what it was almost like saying to a racing car driver, but I need a car. You know, it's not like it wasn't a big deal to me. It wasn't hey, look, I'm rebelling against this thing. It was just like, look, I do this thing. If you want me to do it alongside your other things, this is how I do it. It was as simple as that.
Mm. We will talk about what I imagine was an extremely memorable appearance by Elvis on your radio show when we get to one of your later playlist choices. But when did you first meet and interview him?
Very late, like probably late 90s was the first time I met him. And in fact, our meeting, you know, I'm obviously not a timid person. And it's a weird thing when you're in showbiz, you know, you do end up meeting everyone. You do end up meeting Beatles and Stones and hanging out with them and stuff. And you learn very early on that if you act like a fan, even if you are a fan, you're kind of annoying.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've met whatever, Willie Nelson, Little Richard, and you can't go, oh my God, Little Richard, Willie Nelson. But the only time it's ever happened to me and this is quite late in my career, I guess it would have been late in the late 90s. We used to film Buzzcocks on, I think it was a Monday night, and they used to film later the same night, like two studios down. And it was the most extraordinary thing. You'd finish work and then you'd walk next door and whoever would be on, you know, Dr. John or someone. And it was like going into a bar after work, but it was this, you know, amazingly curated music experience. And, you know, and it was extraordinary. Just literally, you've done some jokes and you go next door and McCartney's doing a solo thing or whatever. And I'm very spoiled by that. I'm not taking that lightly at all. So anyway, one day Elvis Costello was on and I was very excited. And he was walking through the corridor at the BBC and I saw him and I just thought, oh, my God, I've got nothing to say. I've got nothing other than, oh, my God, I love you sort of thing. And so I sort of stepped into a doorway because I thought I can't. I'm a bit too excited to meet him on an even footing. So I stepped into this doorway sort of hiding and he saw me and walked over and he went, hello. And I genuinely couldn't form words. I just went, I've never let her. And it's the only time in my life it's ever happened. And he was very understanding. And we spoke for a minute or two. I guess we had some mutual friends or something. And so that was a really odd meeting. But we've met many times over the years since. And it's always been on nominally an equal footing, you know. And that's the only way you can approach these things. But, yeah, it was a ridiculous meeting by any standards. Hiding from a hero and then being unable to speak. But yeah, no, I've met him a long time. I know Nick Lowe fairly well. And so it's not quite an in. I mean, I think just being in show business is an in because, you know, you're kind of the people you escape to, if you know what I mean. You're not the people who are gonna sort of be too annoying, hopefully. So yeah, we've crossed paths enough over the years that I'm not a shivering wreck anymore. Certainly. Can I just tell you a quick Nick Lowe story though? By the way,
yeah.
He told me. I mean, we'd occasionally speak about Elvis, and I think they're still fairly close. But he told me this amazing story once. He said he was in LA when they were recording King of America, and just popped in to say hello and watch a session or something. And the bass player, T-Bone Walk, laid down his bass line and they finished it. And Elvis said, right, that was perfect. It was just a bit too perfect. It was like, can you play it again? But just like, you know, a quarter of an inch off perfect. And T-Bone Walk turned his bass upside down, did the same take again, but with the bass upside down, because that was the only way he could not be perfect. And Nick Lowe said, and it was the most amazing, you know, bass line he'd ever heard. Yeah. And obviously Nick's a great bass player himself. And I don't know, it's just an image that sticks in my mind of like, God, imagine being around that. And for Nick Lowe, who's been in many a studio in his life, to go, wow, what a moment.
Yeah. A quarter of an inch off perfect would be a great album title as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But imagine knowing you're that good that you, the only way I can not be this good is to absolutely inverse everything I do.
The song you're adding to the playlist from the 1980s is from the 1983 album Punch the Clock, and it's The Invisible Man. I was committed to life and then commuted to the outskirts with all the love in the world. Living for 30 minutes at a time with a break in the middle for adverts. But it's a wonderful world within the cinema halls where a shower of affection becomes Niagara Falls. You wish you could step down from the screen to your seat in the stars. Cause if stars are only painted on the ceiling of our
Yeah, the 80s, I think probably for most people, is going to be the hardest Elvis era to condense, you know, starting with Get Happy, which is pretty much 20 great catchy songs, and ending with Spike, which is all sorts of Tom Waits wonderful weirdness and all those things in between. You know, Blood and Chocolate, there's not a bad track on it. Imperial Bedroom's a particular favourite of mine, but I don't know why I've chosen this track particularly. I really like when he does those just playful, catchy hooks, and I think Punch the Clock was one of those peaks of that, when he went for a kind of pop sound, pulled it off, and carried on moving on. I'm not sure why Punch the Clock isn't quite as rated as some of his records. I don't know why, because I think it's just about perfect. The three things that really got me through the 80s were Dexys and Tom Waits and Elvis Costello, and the fact that it's the Dexys brass section on Punch the Clock, and those really breezy productions from Langer and Weir Stanley. I just love it.
Yeah. Oh, well, we had the pleasure of having Jeff Blythe from the TKO Horns and Dexys on here a little while ago, and he spoke a lot about recording Punch the Clock. So that was lovely to hear firsthand from him. And as you say, it does, as an album, divide opinion. Clive Langer even quoted Elvis as saying, "Fucking hell, what have we done?" But I think personally, like you, I like how it's distinct from the albums that go before it. And back then, every album had its own sound and its own character.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I suspect, in retrospect, because Goodbye Cruel World, which I think is underrated but not a perfect album by any means, I think because it has lots of the similar sounds, and that, I think that's a Langer and Weir Stanley as well.
It is, yeah.
I think maybe that, but I don't know. I've got the album in front of me. Let me see. TKR, I think, is amazing. Charm School, Invisible Man, Mouth Almighty, King of Thieves. There's not many careers who wouldn't be happy with those five songs in a row. No. Never mind just as a B-side of an album. That's The Element Within Her, The Greatest Thing, Love Went. I mean, it's a great album. What is anyone on about? That's a great album by any standards. And again, it might not even be my favourite album from, you know, in a different mood, I might want Blood and Chocolate on or something. But no, that's ridiculous. And I think Elvis is a little bit sniffy about it as well now. I'm not sure.
Mm. Yeah.
Don't get it. I mean, that sort of stuff, you can, and it's sort of self-consciously a pop album, but you can see almost any of those tracks being played on mainstream radio at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, really, to this day, how were they not hits?
Yeah.
How is that? I mean, Let Them All Talk and Every Day I Write the Book have both become sort of seen as retrospective classics, but if The Greatest Thing was put on Steve Wright in the afternoon, or look at me showing my age, he's been off air for a month. But that wouldn't seem out of place.
No.
At all, quality-wise. Yes, I mean, really, I think that's partly why I liked it. I've got to say, like most people, I suspect that first four albums that informs most people's sort of entire view of Elvis is what we go for. You know, I'm not necessarily, I don't like North. I'm not crazy about the Juliet Letters. I don't really like the Bacharach album. I'm just not loopy about the side projects, which to me are like, let's show a different side of me.
Hmm.
We all know the side of him we like, sort of thing. But I think that fits in with those, you know, just hooky poppy songs. God, that's what we live for, isn't it? But take me up on what you were going to disagree with me about.
Painted from Memory, I would happily argue till the end of time about that one. I've probably bored listeners by praising it throughout this podcast series, but I just think it's a wonderful album.
I don't think it's a bad album by any, nor do I think The Juliet Letters is a bad album. I do think North's a bad album, actually. But I think that they are kind of side projects. We know the line of Elvis that we like, and that's the line of Elvis that I'm not trying to, you know, dissuade anyone from liking anything, but we know what we picture Elvis as, and when he goes off on those little things, God bless him, and I'm really glad, you know, and what's greater than King of America, which is a country album, but I don't know, they don't have the through line to me. Not that there's anything wrong with that, they just don't.
Okay, back to The Invisible Man. It was recorded with The Attractions and the TKO Horns at Air Studios, produced, as you say, by Langer and Weir Stanley. Costello using lyrics that had previously been intended for other songs, 25 to 12, Seconds of Pleasure and I Turn Around. And but a few guests on the show who've picked out lyrics that have turned out to be very prescient in Elvis's career. And there's a line here that always comes to my mind over recent times. You know, when you see these awful people finding themselves in positions of power, and then they use it for the most regressive means. And there's that line here, oh, that could never happen here, but then again, it might. And I think, whoa, there's a line to sum up the decade, I think.
Yeah, there's some quite sinister lines in that for a catchy, soul-ridden pop song. But also one of the worst lines, unfortunately.
Shall I guess, or are you going to...
No, go on, you guess.
Shattered like a piece of crystal, porcelain, yes, or alabaster.
It's dreadful. I love it, but it is dreadful. And I think Bruce Thomas is... when he mentioned in one of the interviews, love more tender than more tinder or whatever it was, that line. And I'd never noticed how bad that line before it was. And as soon as someone points out, oh, hold on, you have to go, yeah, hold on. But I kind of like the spirit in that. It's plainly clunky. And I'm sure he noticed it was clunky when he recorded it and wrote it and recorded it and released it. And I kind of like it in the spirit of that. But it's a dreadful line. But also, again, back to that kind of slogan-hearing couplet, though if stars are only painted on the ceiling above, who do we turn to, who do we love? What a, just that one is fantastic in itself, isn't it? That's a lot of lesser talents would have based an album around that theory.
This is Dangerous Amusements, a show with a taste of decay and the scent of defeat.
Okay, let's move on to your next song, and this is a real masterpiece. Tell us what you've chosen from the 1990s.
I tried not to be smart when I was choosing stuff, and I wanted to just go for ones that did mean something to me. And I don't know if Mighty Like a Rose is his greatest album, but it's one that meant a lot to me and still does, and couldn't call it unexpected. It's as beautiful a piece of music as I know.
Saw a girl who found her consolation. She said, one day my Prince of Peace will come. Above her head, a portrait of her father. The wilted favor that he gave her still fastened to the frame. They've got his bones.
Couldn't Call It Unexpected, number 4, was released on Mighty Like a Rose in April 1991. You'll get no arguments from me for picking this for the 90s, Mark, but just talk to me about why you love this so much.
I've got a feeling that this was, during the 70s I was too young, and during the 80s I was busy doing comedy every night. So I didn't see, I think the first time I saw him was probably when this album came out. I think it was. And so that was very exciting. It was suddenly at the early 90s before I was on TV, but I had some disposable income so I could buy new albums and stuff. And it was an absolute thrill when it came out. I remember hearing The Other Side of Summer late night on the radio and just thinking, wow, this is everything I like. And someone pointed out in a review that cynical may be the wrong word, but let's use cynical. That the album opens with the sun. Is it the sun struggles up another beautiful day? And I feel glad in my own suspicious way.
Yeah.
And it ends with, I can't believe I'll never believe in anything again. Mm-hmm. And you know, what a gloomy Sunday that is. But but the songs don't feel that way. The Other Side of Summer is that classic Elvis thing of taking lots and lots of mean-spirited thoughts and putting them in a bright, punchy Beach Boys type song, which he's he's brilliant. That's kind of what he's best at, isn't it? That, you know, punched by a velvet glove type stuff that he does. But yeah, I couldn't call it unexpected. I'm a real sucker for a song in waltz time anyway. I love a waltz time. It's not used nearly enough in music as far as I'm concerned. And he did it on Changing Partners is a waltz as well, isn't it? That he did fairly recently. Yeah, I think everything about it is just enchanting. And wasn't it, you'll know better than me, wasn't it the theme tune to GBH?
Yeah, the Alan Bleasdale drama. Yeah, the melody was used for the soundtrack of that as well, yeah.
Yeah, I think, again, that's an album I've got but I haven't played since it came out. But I remember being a very pleasing sound on that album. But I don't know. Well, you were saying what it means to you. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I love Couldn't Call It Unexpected Number 4, partly because it's on Mighty Like a Rose, which is my first Costello record when I was getting into his music. So I am attached to this album as a whole, and this for me is the standout track on the album. Like you, I love the arrangement. It's so different. Apparently that was all recorded in a single take with the six keyboards being played at the same time.
Wow.
There was only the brass that was added as an overdub, according to Elvis. But for me, I think it's the lyrics on this one. He always writes such visual lyrics, and here you've got, you know, the wilted favour on the frame of the portrait, the terrible faces in the fire, the birds on the high wire, the face lingering at the window pane. I just think it's so evocative. It's one of those songs that you can picture in your head while you're listening to it.
I can train spot on that line about the birds arranged on the high wire. Do you know where that comes from?
Go on.
In the 50s, there was a TV talk show host called Steve Allen, who was he was funny and bright and all the things you'd want from a TV show host that never get. But he was also very intellectual and urbane. And he used to film birds on, you know, on telegraph wires and then put them to music as it was a stage, which is a very intellectual thing to do for a chat show host. But so he would make these kind of symphonies out of birds arranged on the high wire. And many years later in, let's say, Mojo, but I don't know what it was, there was an interview with, or a discussion between Tom Waits and Elvis Costello. And in that, Tom Waits mentions this whole Steve Allen thing. And obviously Elvis filed that away and you know, put that little line in.
Mm.
But it's even without that knowledge, it's a lovely image of just seeing birds on a high wire and thinking what they're singing is beautiful. Also, I think because it follows Sweet Pear and Broken on that album. It was never a single, was it? I don't think it was.
No, I think it was the B-side to The Other Side of Summer.
Right, okay, that makes sense. And on, oh, I've got to say, on the CD version of that, it also had another one of my favourites, The Ugly Things, the Nick Lowe song.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A massive favourite. I think Nick Lowe's, Elvis's version is superior to Nick Lowe's, and I really like Nick Lowe's, but it's a great song. But I think following on from Sweet Pear and Broken, which are both very brittle and quiet songs, it was a kind of welcome relief. It was almost like that song, you know, at the end of a film when you've been frightened for an hour and a half. It was kind of, I think the sequencing of it was perfect. But yeah, that song is as great as anything he ever did, as far as I'm concerned. Do you know what he's ever said about it, apart from how it was recorded? Has he mentioned his feelings towards that song? Is it one that sort of plays large in his canon to him?
Yeah, there's a beautiful quote from Elvis when he says, "Whenever I try to explain what Couldn't Call It Unexpected Number 4 really meant to me, it always crumbled away like scorched paper." And I thought that was, you know, we can try and analyse it as much as we want, but he can't quite encapsulate what he had in mind when he wrote it as well. He just knows what he meant, I guess. But another nice thing he said was that he thought the melody is among his favourites of those that he'd written at the piano, and the lyric contains what might be called an agnostic prayer, if such a thing can exist.
Yeah, that's nice, because you could see "I Can't Believe I'll Never Believe Anything Again" as cynical or hopeful. And I guess that's the little dance he often plays around lyrics. But yeah, all over, a great album. There seems to be a through line, which I can't quite put into words, of, oh, I don't know, hopelessness, maybe, or hopeful hopelessness. Maybe it's that. I don't know. I'm not a critic, and obviously I shouldn't be.
You briefly mentioned before we got into the guts of Couldn't Call It Unexpected that you started going to see him live around this time as well. What are some of your favourite experiences of seeing Costello gigs?
Oh, God, there are so many. I remember when, what was that album? The one with When I Was Cruel. I remember when it was probably about a year before When I Was Cruel came out, he did a gig at the Royal Festival Hall. And it was kind of an experimental gig. And he has mentioned since that gig where the technology almost ran away from him, where he was trying to use those samples and electronic sort of gimmickry, I suppose you could call it, on that album. And it was really interesting watching a first half of a show of all entirely new songs, all in a slightly different style than he'd done before. It was a great gig. And then, of course, second half, he did, you know, a greatest hits, and we're all suckers for a greatest hits. And that was that one really stands out in my mind. That the first time I saw him doing Mighty Like a Rose, or that era, Mighty Like a Rose at Hammersmith Odeon, that was, or whatever it's called now, that's a high point. I saw him once guesting with Howling Wolf's guitarist Hubert Sumlin in Austin. That was just as a poetic name drop, that's a nice experience. I mean, I've seen him so many times. The Albert Hall, when there was it Shipbuilding? But he did a big number with just him and Steve Naive using the pipe organ that's built into the Albert Hall. And it was just literally, I think it was just Steve Naive playing that and him on vocals. I think it was Shipbuilding. It was a long time ago. But I remember that as a moment of a really kind of transfixing moment for everyone. In fact, did Joe tell you the bollock story on that?
She may have told me a bollock story, but whether it's the same one, I'm not sure.
Well, the night we went to, we've often been together to see him, and the particular night we went was fantastic. But, and I don't remember this, but during this very serene thing of the Albert Hall being filled by a pipe organ, in that silence, someone shouted out bollocks, apparently. I don't remember it at all. Anyway, later on, she bumped into Elvis at something, and she said, I was at that gig at the Albert Hall. I was there on the bollocks night. And Elvis said, oh, no, the next night was much better.
Oh, great. Well, while we're in the 90s, this is obviously a period for you where you're starring in some of the defining British TV shows of the decade, The Word, The Big Breakfast, Shooting Stars, Never Mind the Buzzcocks. Was Elvis ever floated as a potential guest for any of those?
I don't remember. I mean, he would have been too old for The Word, unfortunately.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And he would probably have been too successful to have been on any of the others. You know, I mean, like I said, comics seem to really like him. He's kind of a lingua franca amongst us, or certainly the ones of my generation. So I don't remember. And before that, this was a big thrill for me. I used to do the warm up for Jonathan Ross's show for a year or two. And there was a period when he had the Attractions as the house band.
Oh, yeah. That was the Last Resort, wasn't it?
It was the Last Resort, but then he did a show on Channel 4 three nights a week. It was like 6:30 on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And the Attractions were usually the house band on that. And that, it was so exciting for me to, I wasn't really in showbiz. I was the warm-up man, but I felt like I was suddenly. And you'd be in the green room with Steve Naive and Pete Thomas and whatever. And it was thrilling to watch them every night, so perfectly backing whoever was on. Really great. And I remember once the Beastie Boys were on as guests and being backstage and them going, it's the Attractions. Like the Beastie Boys were so excited that the Attractions happened to be the house band on the show. But no, I don't think I've ever done anything on television with him, and not much on radio, to be honest.
Because I remember you had Edwin Collins on Shooting Stars once, and he was great and really got into the spirit of it. So, you know, maybe Elvis could have done something similar there. But when Joe was on, we talked about her appearance alongside Elvis on Fantasy Football around that time. And I recall he did Have I Got News For You around the same period as well. And I think he was always good value on those shows, I think, wasn't he? He was a decent booking for the sort of comedy panel shows of the time.
I think, you know, all comics want to be musicians and all musicians want to be comics. I think that's pretty much a truism. You give a successful comedian a guitar, they're going to go on and do something. And I think we all bemoan a little bit the sort of the easiness with which musicians get laughs. You know, I've been to see lots of gigs with lots of comics, and the musician will say, oh, that one didn't go very well. And the audience will rock backwards and forwards with laughter. And we're like, oh, hold on a second. don't Nick, that would be like me playing the triangle, you know, in the middle of a comedy gig and people going, oh my God, look at him. This is one of the great triangle players of all time.
We may seem happy, like everything's all right. From the outside looking in, everything's uptight. But deep down inside, we're covering up the pain.
In the summer of 2005, Hurricane Katrina destroyed large parts of New Orleans, including Alan Toussaint's legendary Sea Saint Studios. Soon afterwards, Costello performed at benefit concerts at the Lincoln Center and Madison Square Garden in New York. Having survived Katrina, Toussaint had also headed to Manhattan and duetted with Elvis at those shows. From there came the idea for the pair to record an album of Toussaint compositions. Elvis said, "I was the one with the way and will to put those songs and their composer before a new and different audience. I hope anyone who hears those songs for the first time on our album gets the same pleasure that I did upon encountering the original renditions." That brings us The River in Reverse, recorded with The Impostors and The Crescent City Horns, produced by Joe Henry. And it's from this album, Mark, that you've chosen your 2000 song, Who's Gonna Help Brother Get Further?
Yeah, I mean, I really like this album. I really, really like Alan Toussaint, and I particularly love, of all of his work, I think The Apogee is the series of records he made with Lee Dorsey. Mm-hmm. I think they're just an absolute marriage made in heaven. Alan Toussaint, I think, is one of God's great gifts to the world. It felt like, yeah, of course, this is what Elvis Costello should be doing right now. They had done something before, though, hadn't they?
Yeah, Costello and Toussaint had first worked together on Elvis's version of Yoko Ono's Walking on Thin Ice for the for the 1984 collection Every Man Has a Woman. Alan then played piano on Deep Dark Truthful Mirror on Spike in 1989.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that yeah. And that's great piano on that too. Oh, right. So, yeah, they're in each other's pockets. And I remember they did do a session for me when this came out. And it's worth pointing out, I was on Radio 2 at the time, but I was the lowest man on the totem pole. My show was midnight on Friday night. I can't imagine anyone listening to it live. I can't imagine many people listening to it catch up. But it was a real hardcore music show. It was just music. It was highways and byways of music and nothing else. So if I got someone on the show, it pretty much meant that no one else wanted them on. You know, I wasn't first in the bidding process. And when I look back at the extraordinary amount of people I had, you know, your Dr. Johns and your New York Dolls and yeah, whoever, it's because no one else wanted them on, which is exactly why I wanted to be on radio in the first place. Of like, hold on, the New York Dolls are in town and I'm the one who gets the session. That's mad. But anyway, I think it was maybe the second show I did. We got Elvis and Alan, and I would guess it was because Elvis kind of liked what I did. I can't imagine anyone was saying to Elvis, you know what, if you want to go on at 1:30 in the morning on Friday night, there's a spot for you there. So yeah, that was a real thrill, and it was just the two of them, and we sat in it wasn't a Maida Vale, it was in just a tiny, I don't even think it was in a studio, I think it was just in a little room with some mic set up, and they bashed through it, and we chatted, and it was, to have that happen once in any career is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I was re-listening to it just to get in the mood for chatting to you today, and it is wonderful. They've got some, as you say, piano and vocal performances, and then the interview as well. You'd obviously met Elvis by that point. Had you met Alan Toussaint before that?
I don't think I had. I might have done. We went, there was a gig that Alan Toussaint did a gig at the Shepherd Bush Hall, Bush Hall it's called, which is quite local to me, and I did go to that, and I always did get up and sing a couple of songs, but I can't remember if that, and I would have met them that night, but I can't remember if it was before or afterwards. So I don't think I had. I mean, Elvis had met quite a lot by then, so it wouldn't have been that like, oh my God, it's Elvis Costello. But it certainly would have been, no, it was very thrilling. It's very thrilling when you sit in a room and there's probably me, an engineer, and Elvis Costello and Alan Toussaint for you know, half an hour. Yeah. Yeah, I'd die happy with that, definitely. Yeah. And it's a really nice album as well. It's the thought of it's nice. And Toussaint's such an amazing songwriter. It was exactly sort of the respectful project that Katrina deserved.
Mama get up early in the morning. Papa's already gone. Working two jobs for half the what is worth it. You know that it's wrong. Ooh. What happened to the Liberty Bell?
Alan Toussaint always just seems to be probably the finest dressed man in music, but also just a consummate gentleman is how he comes across.
Yeah, he seems that way. He seems that way. I mean, as I said, Dr. John did a session on the show, and he was always, and I think they're good friends, and he was always joking about sort of how prissy Alan is. But that's part of his charm, definitely. Yeah, you can see, of course, he's prissy. He's never, I bet there's never been a hair out of place and a tie out of knot.
Well, Who's Going to Help Brother Get Further was written by Alan Susson and first recorded, as you say, by Lee Dorsey on his 1970 album, Yes We Can. Costello described it as the best thing they recorded in New Orleans for this record. In his words, glorious to play and possibly his favourite track on the whole record. And I don't think we can let the song pass without mentioning that exuberant trombone solo by Big Sam Williams, which is just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's when New Orleans lets rip. It's a joy to behold. I was in New Orleans for a music festival and I realized I'd never been to a second line, you know, the bands that follow funerals, but they don't just follow funerals, they do it as a thing. And it's an amazing thing to watch a second line, to watch half a dozen musicians processing through the streets for hours and people joining and then going off and getting a drink and rejoining or not. And that's how much music runs through that city, that if you're in New Orleans, you'll see a brass band every day. It's extraordinary.
And this was around the time you did a BBC documentary about the New Orleans music scene, I think, around that time as well. Was that before Katrina?
I did one which, I mean, there might have been some New Orleans in there. No, I can't remember what it was called. Redneck Country? Something like that. We certainly would have been in New Orleans. Now, that would have been after Katrina. But that whole Gulf Coast has just been, you know, it's a city place to build cities. It's always been a wreck. I've been going there, you know, on and off since the 90s, I guess. And there's always some reason that there's a building disused. It probably would have been after Katrina. But it's never been a pristine piece of coastline anyway. There's, you know, that whole Gulf of Mexico, I think, is always pretty riven.
From New Orleans to Arizona, Tucson, Arizona, 1978, which is where Elvis has set his next song that you've chosen from the 2010 album National Ransom. The track is Five Small Words.
Yeah, I mean, I liked this. I liked it mainly because it felt like it could go on King of America. And what's more perfect than King of America? Do you feel that? Or is that just me kind of putting things in boxes?
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about that. But yes, when you mention it, yeah, there are similarities. And of course, one of the big similarities is that you've got T-Bone Burnett in the producer's chair for this one as well, who's, I think, such a sympathetic producer for that side of Elvis's music. So yeah, I think there is a bit of kinship between the two records now you mention it.
Yeah, and I think, you know what, T-Bone Burnett, it shouldn't work. He's almost like the Wyclef of roots music, where you're like, oh, not again. But it's always good. I mean, he's totally the right man for the job, isn't he? Sympathetic is the exact right phrase, because I can't think of a bad thing he's put his name on. It's brilliant. He kind of has, whatever you want to call it, roots music, Americana or whatever, running through him so deeply that he can't do it wrong. And he proves that. I'd forgotten it was produced by him. But yeah. Always does a great job, but Elvis does a great job on that. You know, he's so, I think he's beyond being entranced by it. You know, a lot of us when we start listening to country or whatever, it's like, oh wow, look at this outsider music, and country's not really outsider music, and Americana's not really outsider music. It's insider music. It's music for the people, and And once you stop going, oh my God, imagine living in a, you know, a creek in Butcher's Holler. That must be terrible. And when you go, oh, well, that's what people did. That's what people do. It's proper blue collar music. So, and I think people do the music that I tend to like, which tends to be R&B and country, is seen in some way as some sort of poetic struggle of the poor, but it's not. It's just the music that they do. It's the music of the majority of anything. And yeah, I think Elvis is past that romance and into that pragmatism. Does that make any fucking sense at all?
It does. And, you know, some nice lines in Five Small Words. I always like that verse. I stand outside the door, my head is filled, phrases inside, someone's calling out, their voices rise with praises.
Well, yeah, that's probably how we all want to view our lives, isn't it? But that album wasn't, I mean, that was probably, I'm trying to think when the critical decline of Elvis begins, because I think after, I don't know, maybe Blood and Chocolate even, when every new release would have been like, oh my God, what's he come up with now? Whereas every new release now, just because of how long he's been doing it and how many he's released, he said, oh, Elvis got another album out. And I think that's probably how they view it. And in fact, and he's very keen always to go, no, don't call this one a return to form, when every third album he does an album which sounds a bit like My Aim Is True, which he does, and God bless him for it. But I think Brutal Youth's one of my favourite albums of all time by anyone. I wish I could have chose something from that. But at the time, I remember it was like, oh, look, hey, look, everyone, Elvis is doing his thing again. You know, he's always doing his thing.
Yeah.
He's just not doing that every third record that you're looking for. So I'm trying to remember, was National Ransom, I think that was one of those that was, at the time, was kind of, hey, look, Elvis is back doing his thing, but, you know, who cares, sort of thing. I think that's kind of how he's critically mostly going to be treated from now on.
Yeah, I think this is in that period that probably starts mid-2000s, where some of these albums outside of, you know, the hardcore fan base just haven't really landed beyond that. So, you know, The Delivery Man and Secret Profane and Sugarcane up to National Ransom, where I think they're just under the radar unless you're a really keen fan. And there's some...
So, yeah, and Mama Fuku, for example, was...
Yeah,
was
of course, yeah.
...good as most things he's ever done, I would say. But yeah, I mean, it's not like he's had or having a bad career, so let's not complain, you know. And there's going to be those peaks and troughs in sort of critical approval throughout a career, aren't they? Especially when that long and that dense. He puts out a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And certainly that doesn't reflect a lack of quality in those records. I mean, if we just take National Ransom, you've got things like Jimmy Standing in the Rain, One Bell Ringing, Five Small Words that you've picked out here. He's still turning out great songs. It's just that this period, it wasn't necessarily getting the platform that it would have had once before.
Yeah.
And actually has picked up again in the years since, as we'll talk about in a moment or two with the final song that you've picked, where he does seem to have re-established not just a bit of the critical acclaim, but also with his most recent album, commercial acclaim as well.
Oh, has it? Well, let's get on to that, because I didn't know that.
Yeah, let's not hang about in the 2010s. Let's move into the 2020s and talk about Elvis being back in the top 10 in the charts.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. I'm so removed from popular culture that I didn't know that was the case. Well, that was that the Hey Clockface or the Boy Named Iv?
The Boy Named Iv, which came out in 2022 and reached number 6 in the UK album charts, which was Elvis's highest placing in 3 decades, actually since the album you mentioned a moment ago, Brutal Youth, which I think got to number 2 in 94.
Yeah, I mean, but again, it was an album that he when I saw interviews, he made great pains to go, well, don't say this about it. And of course, that's what people like about you. You know, for years I was like, look, I'm not just a bloke from Nevermind the Buzzcocks.
Yeah.
You know what? Yeah, right. I'm just a bloke from Nevermind the Buzzcocks. That's fine. If that's what you want from me, if that's what the thing I fulfill in you know, in your thought process, that's fine. And I think he has to accept that. And we have to accept that too. You know, we're hardcore fans. We know all the B-sides and all the bonus tracks. But to most people, he's the bloke who did Pump It Up and Allison, and that's fine.
Talking in tongues, I began to preach. White falls from the branches, an apple, a peach.
The final song that you've chosen for the playlist is your selection from the 2020s, and that is Magnificent Hurt, recorded remotely with the Impostors and produced by Costello with former guest on this show, Sebastian Criss. The New York Times praised Costello's untamed guitar solos and says Magnificent Hurt harks back to the garage rock and nagging organ of old Costello songs like Pump It Up, and concludes that with Costello and the Impostors, familiarity breeds audacity, not routine.
Oh, that's a brilliant review. That's, yeah. I mean, I used to write for Mojo a little bit, and I remember there was a Cramps album that came out, and I love the Cramps, and I did say, look, they're either stuck in a groove or stuck in a rut, it's up to you, you know, and I think think that's fine, you know, you can be in your groove, there's nothing wrong with that. People are gonna be a bit of enough already in showbiz. Yeah, look, I've heard you do this six times before, you're still doing it brilliantly, but enough already, that's fine. And other people are gonna go, oh, he's not still doing that. But you know, he does seem to be true to his muse, at least, and he always does. They're not always to my taste, but he always does interesting things and worthwhile things. I can't think of anything he's ever done that I thought, oh, what, this is useless. He doesn't do that. He has very high, he's an extraordinary talent, and he has very high quality control. And I might not buy everyone that comes out from now on, but I know when I listen to it, I'm going to go, oh, yeah, that's Elvis. That happened with this track. I went to see when the album came out. Was it this year or last year? Can't remember.
Yeah, was this the launch at Ronnie Scott's?
Yes, I went to the launch at Ronnie Scott's, and it was great. I hadn't heard those songs, and it was great hearing them there for the first time, and he was very antic and animated about the album, as like you would be when you're 22 or something, it was a great gig, and it's admirable that he still wants to do it. You know, he doesn't need, I doubt if he needs the money, but he needs. When I interviewed him and Alan Toussaint, and they'd written those songs together, and I said, why did you do this? Which, as soon as I said it, or as soon as they said the answer, I was like, oh, that's the stupidest question of all time, because Alan Toussaint said, because we're writers, that's what we do. And it seems so obvious when you hear that. And if you're going to be creative, you're just going to do it. It doesn't really, the audience doesn't matter. I didn't know that album was in the top 10. And it's a great album. And it doesn't matter to me that it was in the top 10. What matters to me is it's a great album. And I think, you know, that's sort of mostly been his through line. Although, it, you know, on some, like, for example, we mentioned Punch the Clock. That was without doubt him trying to have a pop album. Pulled it off greatly for me, but yeah, you know, mostly he's, you know, true to your muse. That can't be too bad a thing to want to achieve.
And just to summarize that career and what it's meant to you, what has Elvis's music brought to you over the years?
I think when, you know, because most of the music I like is not concurrent with my life. Most of the music I like was recorded before I was born, so it has mastery and majesty, but it doesn't have that link. And when I first discovered Elvis, I was a little kid, and he was thrilling and exciting and angry, and he was kind of that proper anger that you have at a certain age where you don't really know where it's directed, so just direct it everywhere. You know, he does seem to reading interviews from the time in the 70s, he does seem to have been a proper angry young man. And angry young men aren't necessarily Che Guevara. They're sometimes just the little shit you meet in a bar who's always drunk and wants to hit someone, you know, and lots of us have been there. He's the perfect for my age, actually, because as I was growing up, he was growing 5 years ahead of me. So as soon as I wanted something that was more thoughtful and more sedate and perhaps more profound, he was there ahead of me providing exactly that. You know, Weller's another one. Weller's done that. Weller's, there were a certain crowd of people who in 78 wanted to hear All Around the World or In the City or whatever, because they were young and fired up. And then by the time they were in their late 20s, they wanted to hear Wildwood. And I can't think of any other in my life, any other artist who's kind of been there for me at all the right times. Lots of artists is good, lots of artists is important, lots of artists mean as much to me, but they haven't traveled the journey of my life, if you know what I mean.
A Thank you, Mark. He is on Twitter as Lamar_Mark. His song choices will be part of the Bedroom Alibis playlist, which will be available on my website, dangerousamusements.co.uk, at the end of the series. Follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram. The theme music for the show is performed by Gary Mulcahy.
Thanks for listening to Dangerous Amusements. Now, close the door and deny you ever knew me.